This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. And we're talking about how you can manage chronic lower back pain. Back with us are Lori Tyne Brody, a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Well, we'd like to have you join the conversation, so give us a call. Do you have problems with chronic back pain? Also, do you take your general physical therapy questions? So join the conversation, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Hi, ladies.
Hello.
Hi, Jill.
So lower back pain. It seems like we all get that at some point.
Yes,
right.
Yes, more than once,
right?
Yes, we do.
What is actually the lower back considered?
Well, the low back typically is anywhere from the buttocks up to about what would be your bra line.
Okay.
If you were wearing a bra.
Okay. Right. Okay. So it's a broad area.
It is.
So that's part of the issue, is we have this very broad area, and there's so many joints in this area. And there's a lot of transition in how load is distributed in this area between the lumbar spine and the sacrum, between the sacrum and the pelvis. And so there's a lot of ligaments, muscles, joints, nerves going on in this area. So it is a very busy area, for lack of better terms.
There's a lot going on there. And, low back pain is one of the leading causes of visits to physical therapy. So one of the articles that Jill and I reviewed for today was a study talking to people about their experience of low back pain. Like, what is it? How do you cope with your low back pain? And generally, they found that the experience was one mostly of self-doubt, with a sense of lost identity while trying to cope with a condition that they don't understand. So they're really fluctuating between this feeling of self-doubt, loss of control. I can't control my symptoms. I can't seem to predict what makes them better or worse. And trying to transition to a position where they learn to live with their symptoms.
Right. And it's interesting. I had a very much an aha moment, Lori, when I was reading this. Many, many years ago, I had this weird, unexplained neck pain.
Oh, yes.
And I will never forget this. Lori said to me, there was a guest lecture coming in town, and Lori said to me, "Are you going to that lecture?" And my response was, "I don't know. I'm going to have to see how I feel." Mm. And I had this aha moment, because you've heard that from a million mm-hmm. patients. I've heard that from so many patients, that they're pain drives what they do and what they're going to be able to do from an activities of daily living and functional thing. And it kind of falls in this coping day-to-day category of one of the kind of sub-themes that came out of this, is just it does kind of become your identity, and you lose that other identity that you've had for all those years. And I think that's a big challenge for patients with chronic pain.
Right.
Just quickly, tell us the difference between acute pain and chronic pain, because I think sometimes people aren't quite sure what the dividing line is mm-hmm. there.
Well, that's a really good question, because at the individual level, it fluctuates. You can have chronic back pain with episodes of acuteness.
Okay.
So it's really hard to say, but for research purposes and for the purposes of this study, they defined it as pain that lasts longer than 12 weeks. Most low back pain will resolve in 4 to 6 weeks. If you overdo it, you go out and you rake your leaves or you shovel your snow, and you do too much and you have this kind of flare of some back pain, most pain gets better in that time course. So they say if it's lasting more than 12 weeks, it's considered chronic. And one of the things that came out of this research was that before people can start to learn strategies to self-manage their symptoms, as Jill said, to decide, can I do this or can I not do this? It depends upon how I feel when I get up that day, if I can do this thing or that thing, or how much I can do, or what I should do at the gym, or how I should modify my home activities. Before they can learn to self-manage, they have to have an understanding of their condition. So as a professional, for Jill and I, to start to impose on our patients that you should do this or you should do that as a provider, we have to actively listen to our patients' anxieties and help them identify where they're at on that continuum between self-doubt and that learning to live with pain resilience, so that we can manage their expectations and help them begin to self-manage it. But we can't throw a bunch of self-management things at them until they're able to feel confident in their ability to manage.
I think one of the challenges with working with patients with chronic pain is when they can't find cause and effect. So Lori gave the example of people who, oh, I raked my leaves, or recently I shoveled, and, oh, I had a little low back pain soreness, but it resolved. Many times patients with chronic low back pain, they have a hard time identifying triggers or identifying that pattern. I did the exact same thing today that I did yesterday, but today I have pain and yesterday I didn't. And trying to teach them how to navigate that and the lack of a pattern, I would say, with their back pain is probably, or any chronic condition, is probably one of the biggest challenges that we face.
Frustrating, gives them a sense of hopelessness,
right?
Because they have no control.
Right.
They feel like they cannot control their symptoms. When their symptoms are predictable, I do X and I have Y response, people feel in control. But as Jill said, when they do the same thing day one as they did day two, and one day it's great and the next day it's not, it's really frustrating.
Yeah, I can imagine. So we injure our back. If it's bad enough, we go see a professional of some sort.
Enter the healthcare system, yes.
Sure. What about if it's a chronic thing? I mean, how often do you go and where do you go?
So that's a great question. If it's an individual who has chronic low back pain and they've been instructed to manage their symptoms themselves, many times they'll go down their algorithm that they've been instructed. Oh, I know that when I have a flare-up, I should try this, 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 and this. So if they try their kind of standard care for when they experience an exacerbation, and it's not turning the corner like it has in the past, then it's time to seek care again. Whether it's a tune-up from their physical therapist, entering the system with a primary care physician, something like that. But typically, if patients have been educated and have been successful at self-managing in the past, when they enter back into the healthcare system is when all those typical things that have been successful in managing their conditions in the past are starting to fail.
And Jill just made a really important point, and and that's the education piece. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what we do as physical therapists in this kind of situation is help move that patient from self-doubt to learning to live with pain. And in the beginning, it's helping them understand what their triggers are, if we can help figure those out. If they do something on day one and it doesn't hurt, and in day two it does, we can offer some explanations of why that might be, and that may help give them some control. But a lot of it is about educating them about their condition so they feel confident in self-managing it. And for some people, that happens relatively quickly because they get it, or they know more about it, or they've had experience with it, or they know other people who have been in that situation. For other people, it takes a little bit longer to help them get to that point where they feel comfortable self-managing that condition.
So what are the things that that they can do to help, and what are the— I know everyone's different, but what are some basic things that you would prescribe that for them?
So I think a really good strategy when we spend time educating our patients on managing their condition is, it's kind of a sliding scale. Their exercises are a sliding scale and their management is a sliding scale. So they may be consistently at the middle of their sliding scale. And the first thing we would teach them to do is back down a certain thing. So maybe you're going to back down your exercises by 20% and see if that makes a difference. Perhaps we educate them on taking the strengthening out, but keep working on the mobility, the stretches. So again, it's all individualized, but a good physical therapist or healthcare provider will kind of give people, for lack of better terms, an algorithm. You know, what I tell my student athletes, if the wheels start coming off or you start having an exacerbation, this is probably the first category to go in your rehab. And you should continue with this. And I think that's kind of what patients are looking for, is a little bit of a step-by-step approach.
Sure.
Right. And you may have a set of activities mm-hmm. that are pain relieving. Mm-hmm. So for someone with chronic back pain, it may be lying on your back with your hips and knees at a 90 degree angle. So with a footstool or something underneath, that tends to be relieving for a lot of people's pain. So having pain relief strategies in a set of activities. And then you have another set of activities that are mobility and stretching, and another set that are strengthening, and you implement those depending upon where you're at in your pain continuum.
Okay. Let's, before we go to the phones, we've got a couple of people waiting. Let's take a short break. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today, and Trina LaSouza is our technical director. We're talking with Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tyne Brody, a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW-Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Do you suffer from back pain? Have you changed your lifestyle because of it? Well, join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So let's go right to the phones. We've got Jim in Stevens Point with a question or comment. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. The topic is pretty relevant since I just finished a session with my favorite physical therapist.
Excellent.
I'm 67, and I had spinal fusion surgery when I was about 29, and it lasted for about 5 years, and then I was back and had a second surgery. And that lasted for about 5 years, and I felt pretty good, and then it didn't. And I finally ended up, on the advice of my neurologist, trying Neurontin as a pain management tool, and have been able to stay on that, and it's worked all these years, and haven't had to raise it. But in addition to that, I've continued a regimen of swimming, walking, and daily stretching, and visits with my physical therapist whenever it flares up, and for me it's work, but it's been a lot of work to maintain all these years.
Oh, Jim brings up, I mean, he is spot on. Lori and I could probably take the rest of the day off and just let Jim
answer our questions. There you go.
He's exactly right. He has a very extensive history. He's lived with it for 40 some years. And he's found activity, cardiovascular activity, as well as mobility that has worked for him, swimming, walking, mobility exercises, some stretching, along with some medication that has worked for him, knowing that he has to have periodic tune-ups, and he sees his excellent physical therapist up there in Point and get some modifications or tweaks done so he can maintain his level of activity. This is exactly the kind, he's the ideal person that's self-advocating, does what he needs to do, but knows his limits and sees right. a PT when he needs to.
Right, exactly. So he's on that continuum. He has learned to live with them, and he has figured out what strategies work for him to manage his back pain. Swimming is a great activity. The people that I find that can transition to swimming do really well. He's got his walking, stretching. He's probably eating well. It's not unusual to see the pattern that he has where he had a fusion at age 29. And mechanically, you know, the way your back works is that you fuse one level, but you keep doing the same activities. That motion that used to happen at that level now gets shifted above, below. It gets shifted someplace else in your spine. Someone else is picking up the slack. That level usually begins to fail. So for him, it lasted about 5 years. And then the next level failed, which is why today, surgeons are a little more cautious about going in and doing a fusion for exactly that reason. They don't want to see you back a few years later needing to fuse the adjacent segments, because then you're just chasing your tail. So figuring out what kinds of activities and conservative management, whether it's the judicious use of an epidural steroid injection, some physical therapy, or as Jim is with his Neurontin and his activities, it's exactly what we would hope for.
And it sounds like he has the mental aspect of it under control, too.
Psychosocial is key.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that, Jim. We appreciate that. Let's go next to Patty in West Bend. Hi, Patty.
Good morning. Timely discussion. I just came from my pain management clinic doctor, and the recent MRI shows that I have ruptured yet another disc, L4, L5. He says that since I am doing better with chiropractic, to just keep doing what I'm doing, that it can heal itself. And I didn't think to ask him, you know, what do you mean it heals it? It can possibly heal itself. But I'm wondering if the physical therapist can give me any insight into that.
So anytime you have a disc, a ruptured disc, there's ligamentous structures back there that kind of either get torn, either partially or completely. And just like anywhere else in the body, those things can heal. The million-dollar question is, you know, in what position do they heal? How quickly do they heal? Things like that. So it sounds to me like this is not your first go with a ruptured disc, Patty?
Correct. I have a couple ruptured and a couple bulging.
Okay. So there is also a little bit of genetic makeup to your tissue quality or tissue structure. And so that probably plays a role with you.
Right. How have you managed your previous disc herniations?
Most of the time, they haven't caused me all that much difficulty.
Okay.
This time around, I woke up one morning in excruciating pain, sciatica-type pain, and was immobilized by it for about a week, which is the first time that's ever happened to me.
Okay, so a couple things come to mind. One is, as Jill said, there's a bit of a genetic predisposition to your connective tissue, and so wondering if that's part of the reason you are continually having these disc issues. The other one is how you move, what your posture is, what your strength and mobility is, and I'm wondering if you've ever seen a physical therapist to look at what you do, how you move, how you make transitional movements, what your posture is, examine your hip and low back to see if certain ways you are moving are predisposing you to these injuries,
right,
and if there's a way to minimize that through some structured physical therapy.
Okay, thank you very much, Patty. Next, we've got Brennan in Racine. Hi, Brennan.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if this completely fits within the scope of what you were, the main thrust of the show, but I was curious more about upper back pain, because that's something I've experienced chronically. And when I try to look into it, almost everything you get gears you back towards lower back pain. But I have sort of mid to upper back pain, especially under my shoulder blades, and I've had it forever. And I've done some things to help, and so I have a regimen that I do almost every day with yoga, stretching, strengthening. I'm pretty active. And I would say I left sort of a sit-down job, you know, behind a desk and a laptop, and I think that has helped, to be honest, because I'm moving more, but obviously doing harder work means I need to tend to it as well. But overall, I just feel like it is a bit better, but just curious, like, where I can go to find resources for upper back pain.
Right. Well, we don't see as much upper back pain as you do lower back pain and cervical pain, because as a general rule, your thoracic spine is much more immobile due to ribs and things like that. So many times we'll find that the thoracic spine or upper back can be a contributing factor to people with low back pain or cervical pain, but it's not necessarily always the driver like it is in your instance. But I would definitely see a physical therapist. It sounds to me like you've done the best you can self-managing this. You're an active individual, and so getting probably the proper strengthening exercises and tweaking through your mobility exercises to make sure that that mobility is going to the level it needs to go to is really important. One of the sayings that I have is the freest segment moves. So when you do stretching and mobility, the segment that has the most motion is going to move first. And that's not the not the segment in your spine, et cetera, that you want to get mobility from. You want to kind of pin down those other ones and really make sure that the joints that you want to move are the ones that are moving. So seeing a physical therapist, I think, would be a great idea.
Is that the only place you're having symptoms, is your upper back? And do you have any idea what set this off in the first place?
You know, that's a good question. It is primarily the only place I'd say if I had a trouble spot, it's that. And it could be, I'm a smaller guy, but I've always done a lot of heavy physical labor in my early years and whatever. And I always feel like maybe I just pushed it too hard in my small frame and I compensated using my back too much. And so, yeah.
That's a possibility. There's a couple other issues that can go on in your upper back, some autoimmune kinds of things that exist in your upper back. So I'd see a physical therapist. If you know, you've been dealing with this for a long time, and it's slightly better since you're not sitting at a desk, but I would definitely see a PT for a couple visits and see if they can identify the cause of this. Because Jill is right, thoracic pain is not that common and can be secondary to either how you move in your low back or how you move in your neck, or even your shoulder can contribute to upper back pain. So figuring out where this is coming from so you can direct the intervention at the right underlying cause makes sense.
Okay, thanks for calling, Brennan. Let's go to an email. Pat was wondering what the best exercises for strengthening the back and core are, and what is the worst? Apparently, Pat is very active and athletic, but has two ruptured discs and trying to manage that through exercise, stretching, and medication when needed.
I'll take the worst. The worst is the exercise that's too difficult for you that doesn't allow you to properly stabilize or use your muscles correctly. And I would definitely say, as a kind of a generalization, I think that's where people get into trouble. Mm-hmm. They see things on the internet and they're like, oh, I can do that. And the exercises are too high level. And so as a global statement, I think those are the worst exercises, are the ones where you think you're doing it appropriately, but you're failing.
Right. So the, as one of my mantras is, it's not if you do this exercise, yes or no, but it's how you do the exercise. So lots of people are doing, you know, you can take, for example, a plank. Yeah, I'm planking and I can plank for 60 seconds, but I look at how you're doing it.
Right.
And you're in a terrible posture. You're not firing your glutes. You're sagging in your lumbar spine. So, and it's the same thing with, for example, the clam, which is a great exercise, but you can do it in a way where you're not working your glute medius at all. So that's why Jill and I are really big on go see a physical therapist for a visit or two, and they can tell you how to do this. People are generally fairly unaware, unless you're like totally tuned into your body, fairly unaware of like what muscles you're firing when. Here's a classic. People say, well, I want to do squats to strengthen my hamstrings because, you know, squats, it's a closed chain exercise and I'm going to work my hamstrings. There are EMG studies all over the literature where some of them show almost no EMG in the hamstrings and others show a lot of EMG. Well, what's the right answer? The right answer is how you do it and what you're recruiting when you do the exercise. So it's not exercise A, yes, and exercise B, no, but it's how you do the exercise.
And what's EMG, ladies?
Oh, electromyography, where they put little electrodes on and measure the muscle activation.
Okay, thank you.
And whether or not it's firing. So I'm sorry, Pat, we can't give you the exercise to do, but
And one of the things along the lines that Lori said about the plank, and I use a plank as a classic example as well. We must be related.
We must be.
But, you know, people will say, well, I'm going to hold this plank for 60 seconds. Well, if 45 seconds of it is bad and only 15 seconds of it is good, you are training yourself in a bad motor program.
Right.
So I am much more for quality than quantity. So I like to tell people, do it until you fail. Do it until you feel you're starting to compensate. Do it until you feel you start tenting, for example, in a plank or arching, things like that. So much more about the quality of movement that a physical therapist can show you versus numbers, things like that.
And I can, Jill and I could talk about this for the rest
we
of the
could.
Show.
It's our favorite.
It is our favorite.
It is our favorite.
Yeah. So, you know, again, Jill said do it to fail. So I don't know. Well, I do know. DeLorman Watkins, three sets of 10 in the 1960s.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how did we get to base 10? Like, I've got to
do decimal.
10. How do we, you know, why is it 60?
So
why is it this? Why is it that? Mm-hmm. The other thing she mentioned that was really important. I
must be on fire today.
You are on fire today. Was the motor program. Mm. So I'm all about the motor program. So one of the things that we do, like I have people do very simple exercises. Mm-hmm. But again, it's how you do it. So I tell them, you know, do this exercise and I'll demonstrate and then I'll watch them do it and they'll do it completely different than the way I do it. But they have no idea that they are. So then I'll correct them. I'll point it out. I'll correct them. And the point is, I want your brain to recognize this as the right motor program so that when you get in and out of your car, when you get in and out of a chair, when you go run on the treadmill, whatever, your brain recognizes the right motor program. Otherwise, you're constantly reinforcing the wrong motor program that brought you to us in the first place.
Okay. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. Thanks for that email. Let's go back to the phones. Randy in New Richmond, you're up next.
Good morning. A great subject. I unfortunately have many years of experience with a very beat-up spine. I was nearly killed in a work accident over 40 years ago. Blew out L5-S1, and there's a chunk of that hanging in the spinal canal. I've herniated multiple discs up and down thoracic, and I've also herniated discs in my cervical spine. And now, as I've aged and I'm in my 60s, I'm having to see physicians because I'm losing function. The nerves are not firing anymore because they're being impacted. It's having an effect on my renal system. So I've slid by, no pun intended, for all those years, and now it's catching up with me, and they want to fuse. I was told by a physician, one of the best spine surgeons in the country, that if it were him, he would have me fused from the base of my skull to my pelvis. And I, because I'm medically trained, I told him, no, I'll skip that. I'm riding on the edge, so to speak.
So I assume you've been in physical therapy and you have some self-management techniques?
Yes, I was an athlete at the time I got hurt, and I was not hurt while participating as an athlete. I was hurt on my regular job, and like I said, I should have been killed but managed to survive, and that was, I blew out both knees at the same time, too. So I have a very, very good friend who's now retired who was a spine specialist and general practice physician, and he had also injured his spine at a young age. So he really worked closely with me. He said, if you want to survive this, he said, the pain's never going to go away. He said, unfortunately, some people can't get to that point of being able to digest all the pain. Luckily for me, I have a higher threshold of pain than most. And, I've had multiple injections. I've had thousands and thousands of hours of PT over the years, all kinds of interventional medicine. And it's just lucky for me that my body adapted mentally to the disease, and I'm fighting it as much as I can, because that fusion that they've talked about, I've only seen a couple of people survive it for a long period of time. Otherwise, it ends up being more of a detrimental thing.
Yeah, the whole fusion thing is tough, especially, I mean, you know, fusing you from stem to stern. I can't say that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So what you have are these segments that are supposed to move. And then you have to ask what happens to your pain when you're no longer moving those segments. So the way those little facet joints in your spine get their nutrition is by loading and unloading, which won't happen if you're fused, and by mobility if you're fused. So those joints aren't going to be getting any real nutrition. And I wonder what's going to happen to your
right.
pain in those little joints
right.
if none of them are allowed to move. To me, that doesn't make sense from a mechanical point of view. So I would, you know, obviously continue on with whatever strategies you have. They seem to be working. And we know as we age and you have normal age-related changes in your joints that things get harder. But, you know, you just have to keep plugging on.
Right.
It sounds like you're doing that.
Right. And unfortunately, with Randy's extensive history, that's somewhat of, for lack of better terms, an accelerant that mm-hmm. we see with the aging-related process. So in general, not everyone, but in general, when you have that significant of a trauma, and clearly he had a very huge trauma, that will kind of accelerate the arthritic changes, the facet arthropathy, things like that that we've talked about.
Okay, Randy, best of luck to you. Next up is Tom in Arborvitae. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I've gotten ablations last year and this year, and I have pinched nerves in my back, and I just retired, and it's really pretty awful. And then COVID came, and I've gained like 80 pounds, and I can only stand on my feet for like 2 minutes, and then it feels like somebody's stabbing me in the back. It's really awful, and I'm not enjoying my retirement at all. And so I hope this new ablation I had October 31st takes. It hasn't kicked in yet, but I don't know. What do you know about pinched nerves and what else you can do?
Well, I guess my first question is if you've had any physical therapy and if anyone has talked about putting you in a pool.
Right.
Because with that kind of weight gain, mm-hmm. and it makes sense that, you know, standing bothers you because the longer you stand, the more compressive load you have on your spine. So if you have facet problems, if you have arthritis, if you have nerves that are getting pinched or compressed, then the longer you stand, the more that will increase due to gravity. So to me, the best place to put you would be in a pool so that you don't have all those compressive loads on your spine. You can begin to exercise and you can begin to lose some of that weight.
Right. And this happens a lot when people, unfortunately, I'm sorry, Tom isn't enjoying his retirement. That's really difficult. But when we see somebody who has pain, then they start decreasing their activity level and then they start gaining weight and they're not gaining muscle. They're gaining just adipose tissue, which is more load on their spine. And it's this vicious cycle and it's very difficult to break. And so finding a place where Tom can exercise, and I agree with Lori, to unload his spine and get him in the pool is ideal. And I think you see a lot of that probably in your patients in the pool, Lori, right?
I see a ton of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tom, it's a good thing you called. This is the time to, you know, put your finger in the dam. They've done the ablation. They're trying to give you every opportunity from the medical point of view, mechanically in your spine. Now it's time to start doing some exercise to rehabilitate and recover. So just the ablation alone is not going to do it. And I think you had that experience from previous ablations. So the progressive weight gain, the inactivity, and that vicious cycle, it's got to get broken with some activity. And that activity often helps decrease your pain at the same time.
Right.
One of the things that we see with this in the study of self-management is that people are afraid of exercise,
right.
that they see activity as a threat. And sometimes the medical providers reinforce that by saying, oh, don't do this and oh, don't do that. And, you know, I say, let the physical therapist guide the patient on what they can and can't do, understanding the mechanics of their spine, you know, what their imaging looks like, what interventions they've had. But let's not put that fear of movement in the patient.
And it sounds like he's having mentally not in a good
absolutely.
Place.
Absolutely.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
I
would expect nothing less. And honestly, I think reaching out with this phone call is a really good first step for mm-hmm. Tom.
Absolutely.
So he's already on that path that I know I need to take charge of this. Somebody just needs to steer me in the right direction. So Tom's in a good space to start kind of breaking this vicious cycle.
Right.
I think.
So see a physical therapist who can help direct you on how to begin activity, in a way that's safe and comfortable for you so you can have some control over this. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Wish you the best of luck. Susan in Elgin, Illinois, you're up next. How can we help you?
Oh, yes. Thank you so much for taking this call and having this opportunity to hear what's happening with other people. It would be great to have this as a routine call kind of thing. But my situation is that I'm not sure, and there's a question around, is the C4 occlusion, I have a thin spine. I was in an accident decades ago, and so now I have a complex. And if that's creating a sense of imbalance, where it was really bad, I went through vestibular retraining several times, went to visit a dizzy doctor at Northwestern, and if that C4 isn't causing the problem, and then that's also causing the problem with my lower pelvic area, because somebody was saying maybe it is that this area is causing fatigue to small muscles in the pelvic area, and so that's creating a strain on my back, or I have a hard time standing up to walk. I'm using a cane, and if either of these things, one doctor said he thinks I need an operation on the cervical spine to just clean out the column.
Right. So you have central canal stenosis and thinning of your spinal cord. Is that what I'm hearing?
But they called it spondylolisthesis.
Spondylolisthesis
or yeah. Spondylolysis.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yes. And so it's an issue with your central canal. Is that what they're saying? The central canal? Right. So that can cause symptoms anywhere up and down your spine. It can cause some of the lightheadedness. It can certainly cause your gait instability and balance issues. So, central canal narrowing and pressure on your spinal cord is one of the things that we screen for and that we're leery of in physical therapy. So I would follow a physician's advice. Jill has a furrowed brow.
Well, you just called me your daughter's name, which
I know,
thought
I'm
was
sorry,
very
I can't
funny.
Help it.
thank you for thinking I'm that young. No, so I think, a couple of things that Susan said. She had mentioned she saw a dizzy doctor in vestibular, so it sounds to me like what she's doing is trying to rule out other things that are potentially causing her lightheadedness or dizziness. And if the vestibular system, which is more of a cranial nerve, C8-ish, is kind of got ruled out, then I definitely, it kind of helps with the clinical decision making to get back to that it is probably caused from her cervical spine.
Yeah.
That's what my furrowed brow was. I was kind of ruling things out.
Right. So I would continue to follow the medical advice here, continue with, various physical therapy interventions to help prevent a fall and monitor you for progressive central canal symptoms, and just stay in touch with the medical system.
Right. Charity said she's walking with a cane.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So we just need to be, just really careful because of the risk of falls.
Exactly. Especially now as it's snowing so darn early.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you, Susan. And just so you know, Jill and Lori are here every month. So you can tune in for that. Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Jill Tyne Nissenbaum is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. What PT questions are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to take a look at pet insurance, and then we'll answer your other pet care questions. That's tomorrow, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about physical therapy issues, backs in particular, but we can take other calls as well. And we did get an email, too. Pat in Milwaukee sent us an email and says that his neighbor, who is 88 years old, has spinal stenosis, and he uses a walker for stability and takes pain medication. Would physical therapy help?
Absolutely. So when they talk about stenosis, it's important when you're thinking about the spine to distinguish what's called foraminal stenosis from central canal stenosis. So we talked a little bit about central canal stenosis with Susan. So if you think about the anatomy of your spine, you have your big spinal cord that goes from stem to stern, and that is in the central canal. And then as the spinal cord travels from stem to stern, it sends out little nerve roots that go out these small openings on the side, and they go out to your shoulders and arms and hands and hips and legs and feet, and that's the foramina. What we see most often is foraminal stenosis. So if you have a disc herniation, most of those go out the back. And then if you have arthritis, where they talk about having arthritis in your spine, and Jill and I have mentioned facet joints, those are the little joints in your back. So if you have arthritis in those and they swell, and then you have a little bit of a disc herniation, you're getting pressure on that nerve root from both sides, and that's foraminal stenosis, the opening where the nerve root comes out. It puts pressure on the nerve, and that will give you pain along the distribution of that nerve. And that's where we see sciatica. So it can send pain down into your buttock, down into your thigh, all the way down to your toes, depending upon what levels are being compressed. So does physical therapy help? Absolutely, especially with the foraminal stenosis, where we work on, you know, teaching you a lot of education about neutral spine, strengthening, stretching, and so on. Central canal is a bit of a different beast. It's harder to treat, but it's not the same. So when people have back pain and they say, oh, it's, you know, this or that, or I have stenosis, central canal and foraminal stenosis are very different. So
for sure. And in the cervical spine, your facet joints actually bear a lot more load than they're supposed to in the lumbar spine. So there's a lot of people who will end up with arthropathy at their facet joints earlier in their cervical spine than you will in your lumbar spine. So that you can't even compare, like Lori said, you can't compare central stenosis to foraminal stenosis. And even comparing the facet joints in the cervical spine and the lumbar spine is like comparing apples to oranges. So
yeah, so the end of the day, yes, Pat, your neighbor would benefit from physical therapy. Certainly if your neighbor's using a walker, working on gait, you know, walkers tend to put us in a forward flex position and things get weak and you get tight in your hip flexors in front. So there's a lot of things we can do to help prevent falls and increase safety and mobility.
Right.
And thanks for your concern, Pat. That's lovely. A question for you ladies from me.
Oh, wow.
No, not that I have anything wrong with me, at least, you know, physically. But anyway, so with some of these older patients, you know, I've seen that with people that I know, and they'll be complaining. It's like, oh, I'm getting old. And a lot of times they just accept it. And don't, you know, aren't proactive about that. Is that something that maybe they should think about going to see a physical therapist without a specific problem, but just that they're not as mobile as they used to be?
Absolutely. We don't like to chalk anything up to age.
Right.
You know, and me personally, I am so motivated by the individuals at my gym. Mm-hmm. I left the gym on Friday morning and it was kind of snowing and flurrying. And there was an 85-year-old woman who biked in on a 10 speed to go to the gym with her helmet on. And I thought, I want to be her.
Absolutely.
So I hear a lot of people say that. And even if you do have some arthritis, some degenerative changes, a physical therapist can customize a strengthening program or a program for you that shows you what you can and cannot do.
Right. So as Jill said, I never chalk anything up to aging.
Especially because we're both getting older.
Yeah, both are. I can see it from here. You know what old age is?
State of mind.
Your current age plus 10
years. Your current age, 10 years older than your current age.
That's what Lori says.
That's my mantra, is like I'm never really going to be old. But most of it has to do with what I call disuse or changes that happen because of how you typically move. So for like people who sit at a chair all day and a desk, you get tightness in your hip flexors, you get weakness in the backside, and all that are adaptive changes due to your current activity level. So if you continue to keep active because you believe you're not old, which My other mantra is I can do today what I did yesterday, and I'm going to keep living that way. Then you work everything and you stay active. And, sometimes I'm getting old sometimes is an excuse for not doing things.
Right.
So see your physical therapist and they can instruct you on how to get back into those things safely before the wheels come off and you have a medical problem.
Right. I look at the women in one of the classes I take at the gym and I'm probably the youngest woman in there.
Holy buckets.
Mm-hmm. It's during the workday, so I think it's a lot of retired
people.
And I look around and I think, this is amazing. So a lot of them modify things. They might not be on two risers for their step aerobics. They may be on one. The lady that's in front of me, when there's a certain move, she doesn't get on the riser at all. But she's there. She's doing stuff. She's moving. And they're my aspiration.
Yeah. So my advice would be, if you have not been active and you want to start being active, don't use two risers.
No.
Right.
Exactly.
So you start out very slowly and work your way up. Our mother, I love this. Yeah, she's laughing. Our mother started lifting weights at age 60.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have thought she'd got religion. She called us up. She called us up and she said, you girls should be doing this.
Gotta give it a try.
Exactly. And she went to the gym and lifted weights pretty much until she died.
Yeah, exactly. There were many, many, many people at her funeral from the gym. Her gym friends. So that's a great community of people. If you can find, if that's, as Laurie always says, know thyself. And if you do better when you're accountable to someone else, joining a gym is great. And there's always ways that a physical therapist can find things at the gym that you can be successful at.
Sure.
So, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't be intimidated either.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's a scary thing. And that's a really good point, Jill, because with Title IX, the advent of Title IX was 1972. So people over the age of 64,
somewhere in there,
those women in particular did not grow up with extracurricular activity, physical activities. And so that cohort of women in particular is very hesitant to go to the gym or has never experienced it before.
Right.
It's a new experience for them. And so I always tell my PT students, this is a cohort of people that you're going to need to, that you might need to go a little slower and things like that, but they've never experienced this before. So you got to think about those things as well.
Okay, great. Let's go take a phone call. And John in Menasha, I think, has a question that you've tackled before. Go ahead, John.
Is it plantar fasciitis?
I was going to say, fasciitis.
Go ahead, John.
Okay. Listen, I had an operation for spinal stenosis about 10 years ago, but I've been going to see a physical therapist recently due to my posture issues and difficulty talking or walking, and lower back pain. And the exercises I have received have been helpful, and I do them daily. However, we've kind of reached a plateau. And there is a suggestion that I may benefit from dry needling. So I'd like to know your opinion about dry needling.
Okay, John, I will tackle that for you because I do dry needle as part of my practice. So dry needling can be practiced by physical therapists in almost all the states, not all of them, but we can practice it here in Wisconsin. And the intent of it is to kind of two different things. Number one is to deactivate those trigger points or those knots you get in your muscles. So anytime you have a knot in your muscle, it actually can cause some weakness in the muscle. So if your physical therapist thinks that, I could get John stronger if we got rid of some of these trigger points, then dry needling is probably an option for you. It is just one of many tools that physical therapists have in their bag of tricks. it is not the be-all, end-all, and I use it as a catalyst, or it's like jump-starting a car. That's the analogy I give people. I can use this dry needling to kind of knock down muscles that are irritated, but what's most important is the exercises that follow. So your physical therapist would have to make sure that you don't have any contraindications to dry needling. You're not anticoagulated, things like that. But it's definitely, pun intended, if it's indicated for you, it's worth a shot. But again, the mainstay, John, of your rehabilitation program would be the exercises that follow after the dry needling. So it doesn't replace it. It would be an adjacent to your exercises.
Okay. Thank you, John. We've got like a minute and a half left. Jill, could you tell us a little bit about what happens when you're dry needling?
Sure. So you use a solid monofilament fiber. So there's nothing in the needle. They're very, very, very small. And what a physical therapist would do would be to find that trigger point or that knot, if you will, in the muscle. And you put the needle in and try and kind of hit that trigger point. I say it's like trying to blow up an asteroid, because most people can understand that. And when you hit it, sometimes the muscle itself will twitch involuntarily. So you might get what we call a twitch response. Afterwards, people might be a little sore from the procedure itself, like sore for a few hours from the dry needling itself. But after that, you should feel better. And a physical therapist would follow that treatment up with some mobility exercises, whether it's stretching exercises, strengthening exercises, things like that. We typically do it in muscles that are overworked.
Okay, makes sense. We've been talking with Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tyne-Brody, a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW-Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we'll be back to take more of your questions right after this break for the news. Listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and our regular physical therapists are back with us today, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. What questions do you have for them? Our lines are filled right now, but write this down, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email, and we'll try to get to that, ideas@wpr.org. So let's go to Jill in Wauwatosa. Excellent name, Jill.
Right?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A little over 3 years ago, I started having some like itching on my upper left arm, and it's progressed to both my arms and shoulders, and it's very intense. I mean, I scratch in my sleep until I bleed. And I saw a dermatologist when this happened, and we confirmed that it's not a skin issue. So I happened to be seeing a PT last year for some lower back issues, and she suspected that maybe it had something to do with my upper spine. So I had an MRI recently, which showed that I have a large bone spur in my neck at the site of a 40-year-old skiing injury where I now have arthritis. And I saw my orthopedic surgeon. I went on gabapentin, which helped for a little bit. But at this point, the gabapentin, even after doubling the dosage, is not working. The itching is getting worse. My orthopedic surgeon said he's only seen these kinds of symptoms like twice in his 30-year career, but he believes it's due to the bone spur, and my only recourse would be to remove the bone spur, and then I'd have to have a fusion in my neck. And I'm wondering what you think of that.
So I'm wondering if the bone spur is pushing on a part of her nerve that's causing that
itching sensation.
Which is fascinating.
It's so funny that you say that, because last night, of course, I was reading either the Washington Post or New York Times. One of them has a medical mysteries, and one of them was about itching.
Really?
Yes, but I didn't read that one because I just like ran out of time, and I'm like, dang, I wish I would have read the one about the itching to see what caused it. But yeah, it is possible. It's a really unusual thing, but if it's not dermatologic. So the question is, when did the itching start? You said 3 years ago?
Yeah.
So why then? Why 3 years ago? Is it have things progressed? Are you in some kind of activity where you're loading in your neck more? Or why? If that spur has been there for, what did you say, 40 years?
Yeah, but maybe just with the straw that broke the camel's back with some degenerative changes or something.
It could be, but I wanted her to see if there was anything she could say. Don't jump in like
that. I don't know. I mean, I've had, you know, I hit my head skiing 40 years ago, and I know I've had arthritis and had some, you know, neck issues that I've seen a chiropractic for a long time, but those all seem to resolve. I haven't had muscle spasms in my neck for quite some time. I don't think I'm doing anything different. I do sit in front of a computer quite a bit. I have, working with a PT, you know, worked on my posture and strengthening my spine and all of that. So I've done everything that you're telling other people to do in terms of seeing a PT and making sure you're doing your exercises correctly. But so I don't know how long the bone spur has been there. This is when I had the MRI, this is the first time I've heard that I had a bone spur, and it looks like an arrowhead that's pointed at my spine, and orthopedic surgeon to think that that's what's pressing on the nerves and causing the itching.
So you mentioned that you itch at night. I'm just thinking laying down, she'd be unloaded, but I'm wondering, Jill, have you tried different pillows?
Yes, I itch all the time now. It's just it used to be just at night.
Okay.
Now it's worse at night because I'm sleeping and I don't know that I'm scratching myself until I bleed. But the only thing that really helps is at this point is ice. But I can't walk around with ice on both of my arms. You know, I get maybe an hour or two of relief.
Right. So the gabapentin did work for a while. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So that would suggest that it is nerve pain. So,
and it sounds like it follows a dermatome.
Yeah. Yeah. So fascinating.
Right.
Let us know how you turn out.
And what your game plan is. Yeah. This is new.
Yes.
It's
new territory for us, but it biologic plausibility. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
We
can say
yes.
It could go that way. It could be just normal aging. It could be because she sits at a computer longer. It was right as COVID hit.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we're sitting more at a computer more, and that may have been just enough to tip the scale.
Okay.
Well, let us know how you do, Jill.
Yeah, good luck. And get a split keyboard. That really has helped me. So if you don't have it, get a split keyboard. Mike in Hortonville, what can we help you with today?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a two-part question if you have time. I called first off. I had some rotator cuff surgery on both my shoulders about 11 years ago, and 2 weeks ago, I was insulating my attic, and I believe I tore my right one again. And I'm just wondering if there is any exercises I could do to strengthen that before.
Well,
I need to
absolutely, for sure. I would definitely give that a try. I don't know if you remember the exercises you did from 11 years ago when you had your rotator cuff repair, but if you don't, I would definitely see a physical therapist and get on board with that. Because you may have torn it, or you may just have irritated and have a little bit of a tendonitis or tendinopathy. So, yes, for that. What's the second part of your question, Mike?
The second part is I dislocated my ankle when I was 20 in a motorcycle accident, and it weakened that side of my body. And then I popped my knee out cross-country skiing about 15 years after that. So I kind of walk a little lopsided. You know, I can tell my spine is crooked. I just had some spine issues, and I started doing a lot of yoga stretching and stuff like that to take care of my back. But my knee is kind of weak, and I want to continue to cross-country ski and bicycle, and I do both though pretty regularly. Is there any exercises I can do to strengthen my knee to keep it more stable?
Absolutely. There is, I mean, how much time do you have? So there are lots of things you can do. the bottom line being you really should go in and see somebody, because is your knee weakness from, for example, your quadriceps and weakness there? Or is it farther up the kinetic chain? Is it in your glutes? Is it because your gluteal muscles aren't stabilizing or stabilizing the amount of rotation that happens at your knee? So knee rotation is controlled actually by your hip. So we would really want a physical therapist to look at you and see the source of your weakness and help give you particular exercises to address that. If you had a significant injury to your knee and have some actual ligamentous instability, they would want to give you a certain set of exercises. If your knee is actually mechanically stable and the weakness is coming from elsewhere, they would want to give you a different set of exercises, which is why getting in to see a physical therapist for one or two visits to determine the source of your weakness is what's going to help keep you on your bike and on your cross-country skis. And those, by the way, are both great activities to continue.
Right. Mike has a lot of orthopedic issues. Dislocated ankle, subluxed or dislocated patella, two rotator cuff repairs, and he sounds to be pretty active if he was re-insulating his attic. So we want to we want to keep him active. So making sure you're doing the right exercises would be really important.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mike. Mike, let's take an email from Marilyn. She fractured her ankle a couple of years ago and has healed, but now she has CRPS. She also has negative 3.1 osteoporosis. She uses a treadmill 20 minutes per day, and she does PT from the bone clinic at Frederick, but nothing seems to relieve her CRPS symptoms, and her PCP has suggested she use a vibration plate. Is that safe? And please explain all of those acronyms, ladies.
Sure. So ankle fracture, so she broke her ankle, and then she ended up having CRPS.
Chronic regional pain syndrome.
Chronic regional pain syndrome, which is, for lack of better terms, it's the messages sent from her injury, for example, are all perceived as pain. So light touch gets perceived as pain. Pressure gets perceived as pain. Every message getting sent to your brain is perceived as a pain generator. So it's kind of a miswiring, if you will, after it. And we don't know why some people get it and some people don't. And then she's osteoporotic as well, to add into that, which is going to add to it. But interestingly, I would probably start with her in the pool, just from a desensitization perspective, even though it's not good for her bone.
Yeah,
what are you thinking?
Yeah, it's not bad for her bone. Right. So the vibration, there's some research that shows that that's good. So I would do the vibration plate.
Absolutely.
I assume you've done things like mirror therapy, which is kind of a standard for CRPS, where you look at the healthy limb moving and you use the mirror neurons in your brain to imagine that happening to your involved limb. So we do a lot of mirror therapy, but the vibration plate, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, for people with CRPS, we really pull out all the stops.
That's right.
Like,
it's
we'll try anything to help relieve their symptoms. And there's, you know, we have a lot of strategies that we try. There's not like, oh, this relieves your CRPS. They also do some injections.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. I don't know if she's had any injections about that. Sympathetic nerve blocks.
Right.
They typically do that to see if they can, you know, help manage the pain. So sometimes that gives people a window of where they can exercise and get better. Some people, the blocks work. Some people, they don't work at all.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Marilyn, and good luck with that. Next up is Sue in Eau Claire. Hi, Sue. Sue, are you there?
Hello.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Hello. I had double knee replacements back in 2017, and I was doing quite well and had gotten to the point that I could even almost run upstairs. And then COVID came along, and I had to discontinue my water aerobics that I did three times a week. And I tried continuing walking, and I had gotten up to being able to walk 1.5 to 2 miles a day. But then about a year and a half ago, I got what they call
IT band syndrome mm-hmm. on my right side. And I mean, it was really, really painful. When I would try and move my, when I would try and rotate my leg in, or I can't really rotate my leg out still, because I'll get in this thing where that band down the side of my leg just, it, then I can't, kind of can't move anything. So I've been to a physical therapist, and they gave me exercises, and they kind of said that it comes out of my sacrum, you know, and if I get my sacrum adjusted just right, it'll work for a little while, but then it, I kind of go back and forth. I've been able to go back to water aerobics 3 times a week for an hour, and I try and walk some, but when I walk, or especially when I stand for over maybe 15 or 20 minutes, I get pain down the inside of my thigh. It's kind of a complicated thing. So what I'm wondering is who I can, and I've talked to a doctor about it. They gave me some prednisone for a little while. Really, I really don't want to take prednisone all the time. It's not good for you.
Correct.
I'd like to figure out a way to solve this. The physical therapist I went to, after a little while, started looking at me like I had 3 heads because they couldn't quite figure it out. And I feel, I heard you mention, I think it was a month before last, that there were people that were working with sacrum and hip interactions or something and could figure out where that was coming from, because it's also been mentioned that I have a lot of wear in my right hip.
Okay, that's exactly what we were both yeah. looking at each other going, yeah, this is sounding like hip. To me.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Agreed. So, agreed. So if your hip is starting to go, mm-hmm. you know, that inner thigh pain, yes. that's one of the red flags. So you may be changing how you move, like how you walk, how you weight bear, how, what muscles you use. So back at the top of the show, Jill and I talked about motor programs. And what we see in people with pain is that they subtly change how they move, which muscles they use to enact various physical activities. And then you overload your IT band, and you shift the load here, and you shift it there. You push down on the tube of toothpaste here, and it goes up there. So you, if you're walking and doing this and it's bothering you, you have to shift the load somewhere. It goes somewhere. It doesn't just disappear into space. So if you're not loading your hip properly because it's hurting, you're shifting it somewhere else, and now you've picked your IT band, and now that your IT band is failing, it's actually going back to your hip joint and giving you groin pain.
Right. My first thought was when she said she went from water aerobics to walking was how that load changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure everyone thinks, oh, I'm still upright, but just the weight bearing yep. and the load, yep. that triggered it in my brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for sure, I think you need to get that hip looked at, Sue, and see where you are with that and make sure you don't have hip weakness. I mean, that's my first thought is yep. we got to target the hip.
Yep. Yep. And if you have some arthritis in that hip, and if you've had both knees done, chances are right. genetically you're a little predisposed to some wear and tear. You might do well with some traction at that hip. Mm-hmm. There's traction things you can do at home. There's traction things you can do in the pool, and that may start to relieve some of those symptoms. And you may end up doing a little more walking in the pool
right.
rather than on land until this calms down. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'd probably go with the hip as my next source of symptoms and see how far that gets you.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Sue. Let's go next to Bill in Oregon. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Jill, Lori. I had a anterior discectomy in cervical area in 2005, and I've been maintaining it basically with rowing and a Krames manual. And unfortunately, I just tore my rotator cuff, my right shoulder. And I've got consult coming up in a week and surgery in 2 weeks. And I guess first question, is there anything I should or shouldn't do, simply because I haven't really had a chance to talk to many people about this, between now and then to mitigate or minimize retraction of the tendon? And second part is, what am I looking forward to after the surgery?
So how did you tear your rotator cuff?
A very awkward fall resulting in blunt force trauma on the shoulder.
Okay, so you had, okay. So have you tried any rehabilitation, any exercises specific to your rotator cuff
tear? Well, it's completely torn.
So, okay. All right.
Oh no, they got the MRI and they scheduled everything before they even talked to me.
Really?
Oh, okay.
I mean, what they saw was, yeah, you're definitely going to need surgical repair.
Can you lift your arm up and overhead?
If I do it forward, okay. not outward.
All right. So, in terms of the what should I do in preparation, so the big thing is you want your shoulder to be as calm as possible. You don't want to set up any other inflammatory process or you could end up with a stiff shoulder. So what you want to do is you want to maintain the mobility of your shoulder so that you have full motion and the joint capsule is in good shape, but you don't want to flare anything up. So you're just towing a fine line there. And that's true before any surgery. Like, you don't want to say, oh, I'm getting surgery. I might as well go nuts. That's a bad idea because you're layering inflammation on top of inflammation, and that's a recipe for disaster.
Okay, thank you.
So the range of motion might involve pulleys or a cane to kind of assist your affected arm. You know, nothing quick, no heavy lifting, anything like that is, I guess, what I'd throw in.
Yeah.
Okay. And good luck.
Thanks, Bill. Next up is Claudine in Neosho. Hi, Claudine.
Sorry. Good morning. I'm calling in response to the caller who is having some itching with respect to a medical problem she's having. And I work in the field of animal behavior. I have a PhD, and I have encountered some research that indicates that this itching is related to both pain and anxiety at the level of the dorsal horn of the spinal ganglion. I am reading this from a reference book, but I love comparative anatomy, and I've seen this condition in dogs so much, and I found that if we, meaning me and the veterinarian, treat the anxiety that is underlying, we often get a substantial reduction in the itching as well. So just for what that's worth, I know dogs are not humans, but it might be a path to follow.
Well, that's interesting because our dorsal horn, our ganglion, is T1, right? Right up at the CT junction. I'm pretty sure that's where it sits in humans. So it could potentially mm-hmm. be, as Claudine said, that could potentially be causing the itching mm-hmm. for our friend in, right. in Eau Claire. Right. Okay. Oconawoc.
Yeah. Thanks, Claudine. It's good to hear from you. Karen in Madison, you're up next. Short and sweet.
Whoa, you've asked that of the wrong person.
Uh-oh.
Well, we don't have too much time to address your questions, so.
I just want to say that I listening to your program with extreme excitement about the connections that that Western medicine is making to thousand-year-old medicines. The mirroring work with Feldenkrais and the weight bearing that in yoga and in doing exercise, our bones need that to be strong. The dry needles, of course, is a direct connection to acupuncture, and I don't know how much you bow to that, but I just have to say my father suffered two strokes. He was healthy till he was 88. He had a stroke. They told him he'd never walk again.
Okay. Oh, Karen, thank you. I think we kind of got the gist there. You guys want
to... Yeah, Feldenkrais is great. That's a lot of motor programming and being aware of how you move. That's perfect. And, you know, the dry needling came out of trigger point injections where they were injecting cortisone into trigger points and they were trying to determine what caused people to get better. Was it the fact that they stuck a needle in the trigger point or was it the cortisone? And then the dry needling was born out of that. But it's not the same as acupuncture.
It is not the same as acupuncture. They're on trigger points and not acupuncture or acupressure points.
Okay, great. Thank you to Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network, and stay well.